In the name of God. Amen. Please be seated. I think we have a lot to talk about this morning. At least that's the way it has seemed to me going through not just these lessons, but even some of the lessons that I decided to omit. Do we know that the lessons are determined by what is called now the Revised Common Lectionary, and that the churches of, say, the Episcopal Church and the Roman Catholic Church and the Lutherans, and I'm not quite sure how many other churches, read the same lessons all over the world on a day? So a large percentage of the Christian community is listening to these same lessons that we listen to today. And I've always thought that's a rather interesting sort of global meditation, to turn the attention of such a large group of people to the same texts. And so one of the texts that we didn't use today is a portion of Psalm 17, and I will talk about that near the end of my sermon. But we've got this mysterious, sort of ancient, what was almost certainly a folk story, of Jacob wrestling with his adversary. And we've got a short lesson from Romans, but still, if we had time, we would talk about that always interesting and always problematic relationship between what became Christianity and its originating community, the Jews. And then we have one of the many stories of the feeding of the 5,000. And also, I want to talk at length about that. So, we've got some ground to cover. Place I want to begin is with this story of Jacob. Again, context is interesting. Jacob is not just wrestling with this unnamed adversary. And even the conservative Jerome Biblical Commentary speaks of this as almost certainly a story that began as one of those night spirits that whose power fades at the break of day, you know, fading at the crow of the cock, like a Scandinavian troll under the bridge, somebody wrestling with Jacob. Jacob was tremendously worried about this coming meeting with his brother Esau, whom you might remember he had tricked out of his birthright, no small event in the ancient world. And so Jacob wrestles, and I just give back to you the sense of when any of us might have wrestled or been in agony during the wee hours of the morning, and what it's like to contend. And as one has pointed out to me, is contending, is that what we do? And I realized last night that it's been a long time since I've read any poetry here. And one of those fortuitous things, it was almost as if the book opened itself to the page. And there I'd been reading the story of Jacob, and what appeared was one of Rilke's poems called The Man Watching that features this. And I'd like to read this. It's no less enigmatic than the story itself. It will leave all of us with something to wrestle with. And I'll probably post this on our website so we can have access to it. But I'll pick it up sort of partway through. What we choose to fight is so tiny. What fights with us is so great. If only we would let ourselves be dominated, as things do, by some immense storm, we would become strong too and not need names. When we win, it's with small things, and the triumph itself makes us small. What is extraordinary and eternal does not want to be bent by us. I mean the angel who appeared to the wrestlers of the Old Testament, when the wrestler's sinews grew long like metal strings. He felt them under his fingers like chords of deep music. Whoever was beaten by this angel, who often simply declined the fight, went away proud and strengthened and great from that harsh hand that kneaded him as if to change his shape. Winning does not tempt that man. This is how he grows, by being defeated decisively by constantly greater beings. I put that before us, if nothing else, as a reminder that we are within the play of great forces, often much, much greater than we are aware of. And I think it's beneficial to all of us to open our hearts and minds to really where we are and the mystery of who we are and the play of forces that surge through us and all around us, and what it's like to be in relation to those great forces. So that is all I'm going to do with Jacob wrestling with the angel. I left out the psalm this week because I love this passage from Isaiah. Isaiah, I think all of us should have it taped to our refrigerator, if we still do such things, and maybe read it every day, just as a kind of, again, something to ponder. I mean, I can tell you so many things about this or this or this or that, but in almost all circumstances, it's up to each one of us to wrestle with a text like this and understand its meaning for ourselves from where we are. And so when we hear, oh, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you that have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. What's available that bypasses our monetary culture and is available to all, that is just succulent for the soul and beautiful and available? And then, why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Dangerous words. Global economy in danger of collapsing if anybody took these words seriously. And again, though, I mean, to what use do we put the energy that's been given us? Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? While there is a banquet all around us that we can partake of, which is clearly the message underlying this passage from Isaiah. So, again, take it to your refrigerator and read it every day, and we'll all come to an understanding of it. Feeding of the 5,000. One of the many feeding stories. And those of you who've been around for a while know that for some years now, I have been embracing an interpretation that's fairly commonplace and yet in many circles is held in contempt. People are just derisive toward what they think is a bypassing of Jesus' miraculous ability to turn 5 loaves and 2 fish into the physical food that would feed a crowd of who knows how many. Could have been 20,000. The women and children counted in. And I have, for quite a while now, said, I'm not really interested in that kind of miracle, that kind of miracle that seems to verge on magic. And, of course, the alternate interpretation that has been at work in Christian circles for some time now is that Jesus took a crowd and think to yourselves what crowds are like, even crowds that we know, much less a crowd, say, in the Middle East right now, where people of different religious persuasions, different ethnic persuasions are brought together in a place. And he got them to open a space in their hearts where they could actually share the food with each other. People say that, Jesus multiplied the bread and the fish. And I say, do you really think it's reductionist to get people to put aside their prejudices and their fear and their divisions and join in relationship with each other? Is that something we should, it's just so easy that we can take it for granted while the more difficult miracles are, you know, still put before our face? I don't think so. I think the changing of the human heart, the opening of a space for the human heart is the most difficult and most miraculous thing of all. And it's what we struggle with, and it's what our birth struggles with, and we struggle with it at every level. The wrestlings of the individual heart and in intimate relationships and in families and in towns and in nations and in the world. The issue is always, what's the state of the human heart and what are we listening to and what are we putting into practice? So if Jesus effected the miracle of opening people's hearts and calming their fears, wow, I'm going to say, I know it's being taped, so I'm going on record. I'm saying that is miracle enough for me. But there is a second theme here that I began to listen to in this week's lessons more acutely. And it has to do with what I think is one of Jesus' primary functions, which is to correct bad religion. And I want us to be able to hear in this story that part of what was at work was bad religious teaching. People had been taught, and again, it's very difficult for us to re-inhabit the world of 2,000 years ago and experience not just as an idea, but in our bodies, what it meant to be afraid of being religiously defiled. What it meant to be afraid of becoming unclean because you might eat with someone. Do you remember how much trouble Jesus got in because he ate with the wrong people? He consorted with sinners, with disreputable people. He did this all the time as kind of the lived parable of his ministry. Again, it's really hard for us to imagine the force of those religious prohibitions. And so Jesus was in the situation of the religion was teaching people to be afraid of one another, to be divided from another, to consider an issue, whether I'm clean or unclean in relation to God, as more important than being in actual relationship with the actual neighbor. And Jesus thought that consideration, whether we're clean or not before God, was not nearly as important as how we are in relationship with those around us. When you start reading the New Testament, I think there are a lot of examples. I think the famous story of the Good Samaritan is also a story about bad religion. Three religious leaders walking along the road, and for various reasons, they all used their religion to justify their non-involvement with this beaten man. So then I came to the psalm, I printed off all the lessons. And so even though we're reading Isaiah today, I came to the psalm. And just listen to this a little bit. And then I'm going to pair it with another text from Jesus. Psalm 17 begins. Hear my plea of innocence, O Lord. Give heed to my cry. Listen to my prayer, which does not come from lying lips. Let my vindication come forth from your presence. Let your eyes be fixed on justice. Weigh my heart. Summon me by night. Melt me down. You will find no impurity in me. I give no offense with my mouth, as others do. I have heeded the words of your lips. My footsteps hold fast to the ways of your law. In your paths my feet shall not stumble. Okay, it's the Psalms, of course. They are venerated. They are bedrock spirituality. Now, here we go, listen. Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves, that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give a tenth of all my income. Does that sound to you like the psalm? I mean, it does to me. Which puts the critique that Jesus was generating of his contemporary religion sort of in a new, what surprised me and why I'm passing this on to you is I've always known that Jesus was critical of the religion of his day, and that that's so much of what got him in trouble. But I think he really is taking on attitudes that are found even in the Psalms. This kind of attitude that we hear the psalmist say, weigh my heart, summon me by night, melt me down, you will find no impurity in me. I give no offense with my mouth as others do. Jesus has effectively taken that away from us. Any spiritual path that is based on some kind of scorecard that allows you to keep a sense of your own virtue, and that is based on a kind of division within yourself. This is my virtuous side, and this is my impure or unhealthy or sinful side, which I'm not even going to acknowledge. Anything that's based on that, Jesus has rendered irrelevant. And of course, I think it would infuriate his hearers to hear the venerable Pharisee portrayed like this, almost echoing the words of the psalm. And Jesus said, this guy is naive. None of us is innocent. Melt me down and find no impurity in me. This is the same Jesus that said, why do you call me good? No one is good but God alone. Jesus has taken the naivete of the psalmist who actually believes there is no impurity in him. He's taken that naivete and said, listen, you can give up that game already because A, nobody is innocent, and B, it's irrelevant. Because the issue is not how good you are. There is no evidence in the life of Jesus that the God he knew paid special attention to the pleas of the virtuous. God listens to sinners, which is to say, God listens to us. For in Jesus' mind, again, our language, our vocabulary, when I say sin, I say that with two certainties. A, I'm not quite sure what I'm talking about, and it's going to be almost entirely misunderstood when I use the word sin. But Jesus says, nobody is clean in that sense. And that is an irrelevant question because everybody is loved by God. Do you want to be good or do you want to be loved? And I want us to be a community that is critical, that listens with the eyes of our hearts and the ears of our hearts to the language. I mean, I think you probably noticed that I rewrote the collect of the day and changed it from a Christ who reigns to a Christ who suffers with us still, which I think is more accurate. I think it's a very difficult move to make to look at the world as it is now and say Christ reigns over it in an unambiguous way. I think the Christ who suffers with us still is a little closer to the journey that most of us are on. And so I want us to be critical. I want us to listen for the way religion either misrepresents our relationship to God or, in the more florid aspects, the bad religion all over the world, the fanatical religion, the judgmental religion, the religion that feeds on divisions. You know, it's a curse. And as St. Augustine said, the best, and he was thinking of religion, the best, when it is corrupted, becomes the worst. And please understand that as a human community, we are still on the way to figuring out what true religion is, how to wear it lightly, and so that it points us infallibly in the right direction, and that it speaks to the longings of our hearts in real ways, doesn't manipulate us with fear or dominate us with hierarchical powers, but speaks to the real longings of our hearts and reminds us that we are alive within a mystery. And as Jesus said over and over and over again, that mystery is so well inclined to you. You are loved by that mystery. You are supported by that mystery. And nothing you can do can separate you from that mystery. Come to the waters, you who thirst. Come buy wine and milk without money or without price. The banquet. If we had eyes to see and ears to hear, and it's right in front of us. Right in front of us. Amen.